this unknown comes out of nowhere to lead the pack at Augusta. He's on his final hole. He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think. When we got all of that, the crowd is standing on his feet here at Augusta. The normally reserved Augusta crowd going wild for this young Cinderella who's come out of nowhere. He's got about 350 yards left. He's going to hit about a 5-iron, I expect, don't you think? He's got a beautiful backswing. He got all of that one. He's got to be pleased with that. The crowd is just on his feet here. He's a Cinderella boy. Tears in his eyes, I guess, as he lines up this last shot. He's got about 195 yards left, and looks like he's got about an 8-iron. This crowd has gone deadly silent. Cinderella story, out of nowhere. A former greenskeeper now about to become the Masters champion. It looks like I'm a wreck. It's in the hole!
Whatever you want.
Welcome to Stocks and Jocks. Take it away, Tom. A little ode to Caddyshack, which turned 45 today.
That's really something, huh? Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Jimmy Lawler on the board. We have the futures up pretty heavy last night, but now they're up, but they're not as much up. S&P's up 10, and NASDAQ futures up 72. Dow futures up 39. I'm going to say S&P was up 20-something last night, and NASDAQ maybe 150, so we're kind of back in the middle of that. So we have a little bit of move up. Now we supposedly have a deal with Europe, and the lady made a deal with. I never even heard of her. I didn't realize there was something the EU Commission. We talk about a complicated trade group over there. UK is not part of that. Switzerland's not part of that, but most everybody else is. So it'd be nice if there was some sort of clarity. I don't know if it's what everybody's looking for, and I sent out to all you guys somebody's first blush at what it was going to mean, and massive amounts of less trade coming from Europe to here. But again, it's so early, I don't think anybody can even tell what the numbers are going to be. But just in general, despite the fact that we seem to have somebody who's telling everybody that trade is like not good unless we're getting some edge, the fact is trade is a good thing. I mean, when you start having trade with some countries that do it the wrong way, well, that's another issue. But this general, putting taxes on trade all over the place has been proven to be a pretty bad idea for centuries. But we're trying it again, and we're not sure why. But we have somebody who actually believes in it, and people are willing to go with it. And everybody's running with I said 25, let's make it 15. That's good. Well, I'm not in that camp, and I'm never going to be in that camp. But that's kind of another story. But on the good news, this weekend was interesting. We have Mr. Greg. He said he might call in and talk about the heating oil and so forth. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. I went to a Windy City Thunderbolt game on Saturday night. Boy, Jimmy, what a slice of Americana. Pretty interesting. They're out in Crestwood. Ozinga, the people who did the... continue to do a lot of the concrete in the city and so forth. He was one of the biggest, probably was the biggest owner of First National Bank, Evergreen Park, and they're still real big. They got concrete areas all over, and they were one of the first people. Matter of fact, we almost had somebody from the group on the show to talk about it. They were one of the first people that went with natural gas powered concrete trucks.
Really?
I don't know if you knew that or not. But,
no, I didn't.
Well, you not only needed to buy the natural, and I don't know how it worked out for them, because I don't know if there's new ones that are like that or not. Matter of fact, I'd love to talk to somebody from there to find out. But they also, in order to do that, if you pull, 10 concrete trucks into your yard at night, you can't just have a house feed of natural gas to load up all those tanks for the next day. You need like some huge pipe, as you probably could imagine, to be able to gas up, natural gas up, 10, 20 concrete trucks every night. So they had to do all that infrastructure, and I wonder how it worked out for them. I bet it did. Natural gas has gone up a little bit, but the diesel price, which is the same, pretty much the same as the home heating oil, Maybe if Greg calls in. If not, we'll get him next week. Because he trades at the crack spread, which is heating oil, natural heating oil, gasoline, or RBOB, which is the New York, or the future in unleaded gasoline, and the oil contract itself. And there's an interplay there between the crude, the heating oil, and the gasoline. And because then the rest of it out of a barrel is, you get like 4% jet fuel, and which is basically kerosene, I think. And then you get, I think it's kerosene, Craig would know. Then you get like a bunch of other crap out of there, depending on the grade of the oil. And even though oil has been very steady, except for the one blip up a couple of weeks ago, it only lasted about 2 days, it's been pretty steady in the mid-60s. But evidently, Greg says there's been a huge spike up in the home heating oil, and yet the gasoline, I got gasoline yesterday for $3.13. It's the cheapest I've got in a long time. Most of the other stations are $3.20, $3.25, but the Myers was $3.13. So for whatever reason, gas has not gone up, but heating oil has. So if you're in crack spread crushes these soybeans, then the crack spread, it's been a pretty dicey last few weeks, which is, and you wouldn't even notice. I did notice that diesel, when I bought gasoline yesterday, was 50 cents more than the unleaded, which is kind of weird. And then there's the ethanol, which is a little lower. But anyway, I went to see the Windy City Thunderbolts, who had been getting their ass kicked, but they actually played very well. And it's talk about a slice of Americana. It's a lot of Hispanic families there, but you can get there's three or four party events, and or party, you know, whatever little houses that they can block off people. And I think it's $10 a ticket. I don't know if there's more expensive tickets, but I don't think there are. And I think the kids under 12, either free or darn near free. Beer is a decent price, all that kind of stuff. And people are in there and they're having a good time. An amazing amount of Hispanic families. And it's I often look at that group. And it's funny, Jimmy, how they all, the whole family's all there, grandma and grandpa. And the kids all, everybody takes a turn for a minute or two holding on to the kids. Everybody seems happy. they love the, I mean, the kids are, it really is a whole, it's, everything's a three-generational event. And we had one group in the parking lot. I almost would have invited my ass over because they're cooking all the stuff on the big Weber. God, did it smell good. And everybody goes in. The game was 2 hours and 10 minutes. And they had been, like I said, getting their ass kicked, but they won 2-0 on Saturday. And yet another chapter in never tell a book by its cover, Jimmy. The pitchers were pretty much dominating. The pitchers are, they're all 80, 89, 88, 90, maybe a 91 in there. So it's like major league, only, you know, 5-6 miles an hour less. And the people in the field, they're all pretty good. I mean, boy, if you make those guys into a softball team, I think you'd win. So there's a guy on first base, and dude comes up, the second baseman, I don't know what his name was. Jimmy, the guy can't be 5 feet on a good day. I'm thinking, God, where'd they get this dude? Well, so the guy whacks one and hits the wall for a double. Guy scores. They're up 1-0. They end up scoring another one in the bottom of the eighth. And then the game was 2 hours and 10 minutes. Big fireworks show afterward. I don't know anything about fireworks, but if you just looked at the fireworks show, you'd say, you know, it was really nice. I mean, it was, you know, it wasn't some skimpy show, but what is the difference? I'm not asking this because I think you know this, but the display, like, is almost as nice, like at Sox Park or some other place. Yet, if you look at it, they don't go as high. I mean, the colors and stuff are all kind of the same. But like the ones at Navy Pier or the ones in the lake, they go up, you know, what, 200-300 feet before they go off. These are probably going off like maybe 90 or 100 feet.
I think actually, Chief, it has to do, and I had a friend who ran some of these. It has to do with how much of the explosive part is in it that shoots it up into the air. As he was saying, like he did it up in Lake Geneva, it depends on how much you mix in is how high the fireworks will go.
It's got to cost more if you want them going up a lot higher, I would think.
Yeah, you buy them in pots, but he was saying that It's how you mix it. Like if you put in a certain amount of magnesium, you get a more bluer. It's kind of, it's pretty interesting. The
I'm just talking about the actual height of the, before it goes off.
It has to do with how big the can is.
Ah, okay.
That's basically what launches it. My real question is, you were there, what were the prices? Were the beer prices the same?
For
cheaper?
16 ounce was, I'm going to say six something, and the 32 ounce was like nine.
So cheaper than on the Chicago ballparks.
Oh, yeah. And Aud had a margarita, and I think she said the, we said it was really good. It was like $11.
And speaking of when you said heights, I was watching the Cubs game, Cubs Sox. Obviously, Cubs did win. They won 5 out of 6. Do you know what the average height of a Major League Baseball player is?
I'm going to say 5'10".
It's 6 to 6'1".
Wow, getting bigger, eh?
And it totally depends on what positions. Obviously, in the outfield, you go from Aaron Judge, who's 6'8", 6'7", to guys that are, 5'8". But the average position baseball player is between 6 and 6 feet. Catchers are the same way. They go. They went through second basemen are technically smaller, but the interesting shortstops are now about 6'2".
Yeah, well, I remember when Don Kessinger played shortstop for the Cubs. It was a big deal because he was a former basketball player.
Right, and and they said the same with like Cal Ripken, who was about 6'4".
He's a big guy. He's big. I think they would probably make him. Well, the Sox are already trying to do that with the Montgomery guy.
Yes,
they had him at third base, and I don't know. So sure, that's the.
Yeah, and surprisingly, yesterday the winning run he gave up, he gave it away. There was a double pickle. Horner got into a pickle, and Happ started to go towards home, and he threw it. And because Montgomery is not skilled or knowledgeable enough, was in the base path and blocked the runner's ability to get back to the base, and therefore they let Happ go home and gave the run. Now, it's a mistake. He's learning, but he's a pretty big guy. I don't know how big Montgomery
is. 6'4", 220 or something.
I would say at least that. I think they had him at 6'5", 225, but it was kind of funny because, yes, he was in the base path before the ball had gotten to him and then the ball had knocked away. And the ump was right there and said, turn to Happ, pointed to home, and Happ went home. And he looked a little befuddled. The Sox manager
think that was a horrible call.
The manager came out, but when they looked at it, the announcers and everyone, they knew it. He was right in the middle of the base path, and you have to give the runner the right to get to the base.
Yeah, except he was 10 feet from the base.
I understand that, but the rule is the rule. I mean, he has to give the runner a clear path to the base.
Well, I think that rule is a little bit bizarre, but that's just me. I mean, I understand what they're trying to do is stop people whacking into the catcher, and they're trying to stop the catcher from blocking the plate. But if you've got the ball and the guy's running toward you, the guy doesn't have to run into you 15 feet from the base. He could just say, I'm out, give it up. And what do you got to do, get out of the way so he can run by you?
I don't know, but Happ hit him pretty hard.
That's what I'm saying. That's pretty bizarre.
But we do have John on the line.
We'll drag him in. I'm trying to find all the different teams in this league here, but his website's kind of a Thunderbolt TV, Thunderbolt this and that. Well, Mr. Flanagan, how are you? Unmute thyself.
Doing well, Tom. How about you?
Doing all right. I was saying I went to the Thunderbolt game the other night. It was very nice. Then yesterday, I can't believe these guys pulled it off. We actually had a reunion of a lot of the people who traded on the floor together in the OEX pit and a few other spots, and it was really nice. I mean, a lot of people there, and a lot of guys, a lot of guys look pretty good. I was kind of surprised, but there's guys that I haven't seen them in 20 years. They don't look any different. I mean, some people do, but I mean, everybody's aged a little bit, but I'm going to say they did pretty well, and it's, you know, it was really good to see everybody. I mean, really good. And I had a great time. And then Audrey and I went. Of course, she was the only girl there. But, you know, she was on the trading floor. She knew everybody, so she had a nice time. Not like she didn't know anybody, but it is weird. She was the only girl. But anyway, that was a lot of fun. And I was talking to my, I made it to my niece and my sister-in-law. Both had a birthday last week, so my brothers, and talking to my sister-in-law, her brother was there, actually, because he traded on the trading floor. He's still trading, in fact. He's in the box exchange, I think, where the hell that is. And she was saying, boy, you know, you get those guys are, you know, you know them for a long time. And I said, you know, her name is Maria. I said, Maria, you know, other people don't really understand the bond. I mean, these are people that, well, first of all, I don't know how the guy, Mike Coyle, managed to get the thing together, because it's like herding cats. I mean, talk about independent people. But these are people, and it looks like just a scruffed up version of regular people, right? And Sabrina, you don't understand. I've seen these people for 20 years. I watched them on good days, bad days, and the amount of money, and I've probably traded with everybody in the room on average of 300 times. Never a question, no matter how bad the trade was for me or them, of it not being good. And these are people that if you had the wherewithal, you'd co-sign every mortgage in that room. I mean, you wouldn't even think about it. I said, that's a bond that no other people have. You've never seen people doing things like that. And people say, you're just trading. What's the big deal? Well, if on a big day move from the OEX, if I bought 100 or something from you at a 1 1/8, and I sold it to Jimmy at 1 1/4 10 minutes later, and it was a good trade, okay, 100 times 1250, $1,250. You say, okay, I just made 1250. I know it's a good trade. Well, then the end of the day, they could have moved $8 or $10. If they moved $10, you're talking about $100,000 on one side and $100,000 on the other. And if one person said, "Oh, I don't know that trade, or that was a bad one, I'm just not putting that one in," it's not just you bought them here and you sold them there. If all of a sudden one of them is not good, not only your position screwed up, your profit, your equity, I mean, it's a whole different. Some days I would do, on real busy days, 300, 350 trades in person, by outcry, written down by hand. And when you can do that with people without any shred of fear that maybe they're going to weasel out on you, if people's word wasn't their bond, the whole exchange would shut down in 10 minutes. Now it's electronic, and you never get to see the thief on the other side, you know, and it's different. Some ways better, some ways not so much. And when you see people, you don't go to any restaurant and look around 50 people around you and say, gee, all these people are honest. You know, God help you if you even cheated at golf when the big golf outing we'd have every year. And you know, it was. I mean, God, if you ever, because there was pretty good betting on it. If you ever thought that somebody ever shaved a stroke on that, and nobody traded with them on Monday. I mean, that's how strict people were on this. I mean, can you imagine that today? Can you imagine that in Washington, for God's sake?
Yeah, I can imagine it in any group effort.
Yeah, I mean, and people look at you. What do you mean you didn't? You didn't have this done electronically? Nobody was watching you? No. What do you mean? Now they have, it's electronic, and they have people from FINRA standing around the pit watching people. Why do you got to watch people? All somebody has to do is screw somebody once, and they're out of the business. People can discipline themselves. They don't need somebody standing around them, do they? Or maybe they do. I don't know.
You know, where does that come from, Tom? That's kind of enforcement that you can't really buy or train people to do. It's stronger than that, and it comes from something pretty deeply seated.
Well, it's a product, and we were part of stock options were the CBOE's product, and the people were there were making a, you know, most people are good living. I don't know, how would you describe it when you say people are making a pretty good living when probably 4 out of 5 people after 2 months quit? You know, it's kind of it's like saying people in real estate like Audrey are making a pretty good living, but oh, by the way, there's 50% less, you know, I don't know how many the numbers is, less agents than there were 5 years ago. I mean, not everybody walks in the door makes a good living. I mean, 20 years after I took the test, I'm going to say maybe 2-3 people in my class, for lack of a better term, were still there. I mean, it's not for everybody, but you know, just the idea of having, you know, 1,500 people or 2,000 people in one room all doing something. But if all of a sudden word got out that trades were no good on the CBOE, first of all, the person couldn't trade. And if it was a brokerage firm that, you know, all of a sudden the guy disappeared the next day, well, I mean, the exchange would probably make it good, but the, I mean, you couldn't not be honest. It's like a butcher shop. You know, if you all of a sudden somebody goes home and they bought a pound of burger and they get home and find out it's 12 ounces, well, there goes your butcher shop, right?
Yep.
You would think. I mean, the idea that, I mean, this is kind of a new idea, and it's really sort of a, I don't know what political party thinks it's more than the other. I mean, I don't know if you go down that road, but the idea that somebody has to be watching somebody all the time, I mean, is crazy. I mean, how could you have built the Golden Gate Bridge up in those towers with the rivets if for every person doing the riveting and somebody handing them the rivets, you had three regulators watching them? I mean, what's the point of that? I mean, you know, the idea of, Pullman didn't not produce a crummy railroad car because somebody was watching him. It's bad business, and it's a sense of pride. I mean, you know, you had your own inspectors, which isn't to say it wasn't a crook in the railroad business at some point. I'm sure there was, but the idea that you design a car, okay, you put on a thing. Here's this piece. It's supposed to be, you know, 10 inches plus or minus, you know, a 32nd or something, or maybe a 64th, depending on how important the piece was, and you every tenth and inspect like every tenth one or something. Well, you do that. You don't need somebody from the government standing there watching everybody. I mean, what is his job exactly?
Well, I think the job of most oversight mechanisms is to hoodwink people into thinking, you know, that the system is airtight. None of this, you know, funny stuff is tolerated around here. Look at all the, you know, evidence we have of how much we care about this. It's crept into everything where there's waste. Of course, that's pretty much everywhere, or an attempt to hide waste. And the best way to hide waste is by having a big oversight mechanism to make people think there is no waste.
Well, yeah, I mean, in this country, one of the things that are, I think we're probably, I bet even more than Iran, if you look at the police state we now have, it's scary, John. I mean, I did a study, well, a couple years, study, I looked at, I forget even what the number was. We have, what is it, 65,000 people? Jimmy, after the break, why don't you look at, we have, what, 65,000 people working for TSA? You look at how many policemen there are, how many state policemen, how many private security firms. I think I came up with a 300,000 person number or some crap that are watching other people, and yet we have nothing but crime. I don't get it. I mean, was Jefferson one of those guys? You know, it's more than me. Say it was something about the Constitution and other stuff. It said it's not a substitute for morality or something along those lines.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, S&P futures up 10, NASDAQ futures up 77. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks,
stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here,
right now, right now. We're back. Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell, Jim Lawler on the board. There's Jan Flanagan in studio. We'll also have Nancy in a little bit. S&P futures up 10, Nancy futures up 79. Again, we were up way more last night on the alleged trade deal with Europe, which I think still has to be voted on, but I'm not even sure who votes on this, Jimmy, but maybe John knows. But I mean, the European government is so weird, but because the EU does a bunch of stuff, and they've had their big group in Brussels, and then countries do some stuff. I don't know if the countries have to individually okay something like this, or whether the European Union can do it on their own. I don't know. We'll figure this out as it goes forward, assuming the thing even goes through. Over in Europe, we've got a four-month high here. The DAX up 36, isn't that much, 0.1%. FTSE down 9, so they're not at a high yet. CAC round up 36.4, so the celebration was much bigger last night. Nikkei down 457, it's 1.1%. That's kind of a lot. Hang Seng up 173.7%. Shanghai up 4, call that flat. So Nikkei and Hang Seng go in different directions, and Shanghai flat. So that's interesting. Bonds up 2 base points, 4.40 on the 10-year. Still cannot seem to make it to 4.5. Not that I want it to, but it's the 30-year is having trouble making it to 5. It gets there, and it comes right back down. So that's interesting. The bond down 2 basis points, 2.70. We've got oil. Center is up 80 cents here today. It's a whole full percent. Still 65.94, right in the middle 60s. Brent up 81 cents, 69.25. Natural gas down 3 cents, 307. RBOB up 2 cents, 212. Gold is up 90 cents, so muted. That's 33.36. Silver down 11 cents, 38.25. We've got foreign exchange. Dollar's up a little bit. It's 116.5 against the euro. A couple weeks ago it was 117, as everybody recalls. The British pound, 134. It actually topped 135 a couple weeks ago, so the dollar is stronger in the last couple of weeks. And we have Bitcoin down $500 to 118.513. Jimmy, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. I didn't think the Cubs were going to back and win the next two, but they did.
Yes, they did. Well, it is 79 degrees in Chicago at 6:35. Of course, it is going to be humid and possible thundershowers. So we do have possible flash flood warnings for the rest of the day. The high will be 89, and tonight the low is 77. In Phoenix, they are 86 degrees and a high of 113. And, of course, that is a heat warning. It'll be low tonight and will be about 80 degrees. In traffic, the inbound Kennedy from the Montrose is 18 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook, 33. The inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 19. The inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is 14. And the inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan is at 20. And yes, you are right, Chief. The Cubs won 5-4. Yesterday won the series 5 out of 6 games. The problem, the Brewers did beat the Marlins in the bottom of the ninth, so the Cubs and the Brewers are still tied for first. And the Pirates won over the Diamondbacks. Getting back to you, yes, I did find out that each country in the EU does have to vote on, has to look over the deals and vote on the deals. Interesting enough. And on your other question, it is 50,000 people work for the TSA.
That's probably down a little bit.
A little bit. At one point, it was 60,000.
Yeah, that's the last time I looked. It's a lot. The group that these Thunderbolts are in, Jan and Jimmy, is the Frontier League. And there's the Atlantic Conference, the East and North Division. There's a Midwest Conference, Central Division, and there's the Midwest Conference West Division. That would be the Gatefield Grizzlies. I got to assume they're St. Louis, but I don't know. There's the Schaumburg Boomers, the Mississippi Mud Monsters. Now, that's a team Stocks and Jacks would like to be on, probably. Then there's the Joliet Slammers. And at the bottom of the pack is the Windy City Thunderbolts.
Now, what is the name of the league?
It's the Frontier League.
Frontier League. Okay.
But these are all teams that are not affiliated because they're all too close to the city. What's John? How far is it from here to King County? The King County Fairgrounds are right near the fairgrounds. I think the Major League with disgusting antitrust exemption. You can't have a Major League team cannot have another affiliated team within, is it 70 miles? 60, whatever how far it is to the Kane County Fairgrounds, they're like, you know, half a mile over the border. So they actually could be somebody's A team. They might have been the Cubs A team way back when they're in South Bend. But so now you talk about the Schaumburg Flyers, the Gary Railcats, these guys, and who's the other dudes? There's like four teams that are in the Chicago area, and they're not affiliated with a major league team. So what they do is they go out and they have tryouts, and if you want, we could go try out. They have scheduled tryouts, and if people make the team, they have coaching. Matter of fact, wasn't this guy who just died, Bobby Jenks, wasn't he their coach? The guys in the Southside team, I want to say? I think he was. But then they give people some coaching, and I imagine you make a few bucks. And if a major league team wants you or sees you or something, I suspect they must have to buy the contract and maybe pay the team something for your contract. Probably not very much, but some reward for, you know, the person. Sort of like, as I keep talking about, maybe where some of the small colleges are going to end up. We're not in the business of recruiting guys, bringing them here for 2 years, paying their tuition, coaching them, and all of a sudden, you know, Alabama or Notre Dame wants a guy. Well, at some point, I think Alabama or Notre Dame have to pay when this all shakes out, John. I would think. Hey, speaking of which, let's see who's in the Atlantic Conference. New York Boulders, the Down East Bird Dogs, New Jersey Jackals, and the Sussex, where's Sussex County, Jimmy? Sussex County Miners are kicking ass.
New Jersey.
So there's four teams there. That's in the East Division. The North Division is the Quebec Capitals. There you go. Tri-City Valley Cats. Ottawa Titans, the Brockton Rocks, ROX, and the Trois Rivieres, ALGLES. I don't know why my French isn't so good. Whatever that is, that's their division. So there you go. They're all over the place. And then there's a whole western part of the country in the, I think, Division Two. So there you have it. But, yeah, you know, John, I was talking to a dude Friday night, and he, you know, he's part of our, stops over and has a drink with us, and young guy, and he, you know, nice guy, and he was talking about Trump's executive order regarding payment for college sports, and I didn't read the thing, but everybody sent it around on Friday. But then Trump, yet another executive order, talking about how it was either restricting payment for college sports or something. So this guy says to me, "Chief, you've got to be real happy today." I go, "Well, why is that exactly?" He says, "Well, because Trump passed this thing, and you weren't into the, you know, this big payment for college sports." I said, "I never said I wasn't into paying people when you essentially have a professional team, and the people doing the playing are the only ones not getting paid." I mean, I'm not sure I like that model at all. But to go to the fact, you know, why is it a professional team these days? Anyway, it's a long story we won't get into. And he said, "Well, yeah, well, now that's all changed." And I said, "What do you mean it's all changed? There's a Supreme Court decision. Congress just came through with some law regarding this stuff, which I think is kind of absurd because I don't think they ever understand the situation." But and I said, "What do you think this is? Like, is it a law?" "Well, yeah." I said, "No, it's not. It's an executive order." I said, "If I ignore it, you can't prosecute me. There's no penalty for breaking an executive order that I know of, other than Trump's pissed off at you, which may be enough. I mean, I said, no judge is going to say you defied an executive order. I said, most executive orders are for the executive, like, enforcement on what you're going to do this and that. You can't create a law. You can't say there's a 10-year penalty on paying a college kid. It didn't come out of Congress or a state or someplace. Am I right on this or not?
Yeah, that would make sense. I mean, it's, you know, an executive order deals with the executive powers, and the executive powers, this is the whole mess with Obamacare, remember. You know, is it a tax? What kind of enforcement measures does it have?
Well, that actually passed, the health care bill.
Well, and the Supreme Court, you know, did some gymnastics to get the result they wanted that time, too. But yeah, it isn't like you can have a whole fee structure or anything out of this. So somebody's going to have to vote on that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how. And why can't these guys just leave it alone? I mean, they've already wrecked it. Why don't they leave the new version alone without trying to shape it? If 50 colleges want to have a sponsored professional team, Jen, I don't know where. In a supposedly a free market, let them do it. I mean, whether it should be tax free or any of those kinds of things, that I have a real issue with. But why can't it just be a? I don't like it, but why can't it just be a semi-professional team feed into the other?
Well, like a bowling league model or something, where you buy the shirts. And the
yeah, I mean, do you think people like you and I are not going to figure out that the Notre Dame sponsored professional team is not the same as the one with the school there? I hope we're smart enough to know the difference.
I do too.
I mean, if Alabama's paying everybody on the team as much as the, I was going to say their professional team, they don't have a professional team in Alabama, they're paying these guys half as much as the Bears, and the idea of them being students is a laugher. Okay, it's a different model. I don't like it. And I think at some period of time, people from Alabama are going, I don't know if I want to support that as much. Maybe they do. I mean, people support the Bears for no reason, right? I mean, you know, does anybody? I think everybody. We went to after the game. God, it was kind of late for Rod and me. We went out to. Of course, we had to find anybody who was still serving something to eat at 10 o'clock, right? So we you know, it's a good place in Orland, and we go there, and it's. This place is—it's a huge joint. All these million TVs, kind of a sports bar. Well, as the night wears on, there's less people. They just like close one of the bars when they were in one of them. I had no idea. Maybe Jimmy is still up at 10:30. What? There's got to be how many shows are on these sports channels with three or four idiots there, all being mini general managers? That's all they talk about.
At least a half a dozen.
I mean, it's everybody. Everybody's a, you know, a semi genius in their own mind. Make this trade, make that trade, and everybody, you know, we shouldn't have this guy, like if they're paid by the team. By the way, he's making too much money, he's ripping the Bears off. Why do we give a crap whether the Bears are paying somebody too much money? The team's making what, $150 million a year? That's going to be my worry, that they pay some guy more than I think he's worth? I know that's what drives the value of these teams, you know, fan being fanatic, but really? Anyway, I don't know what an executive order adds to this mess, and I don't know where, you know, whether like him or don't, where all of a sudden we have a president who thinks he needs to opine on every single issue in the world in an executive order. Hell, we don't do that on the show, and that's what we're on here for.
Right.
is the second guess people. I mean, what do we do? We got to put on a Stocks and Jacks order every day of something we don't like, a college we don't like, this we don't like, that. When did that become the job of the president? I'm just curious on that. But
well, I think it's just the blowback from coming out of a period when the president was doing nothing. So now we're actually seeing.
You mean the Bush years or Biden years?
Well, the Biden years, most immediately. But you know, there's patterns of this in the past.
So you think Biden should have issued executive orders regarding college football?
No, I'm not saying he should have. I'm just saying the fact he didn't do pretty much anything, at least that he can call his own. This. Contrast quite strong with what we have now.
Well, he put one huge bill together in Trump's first term. He put one huge bill together. I mean, neither one of them did a hell of a lot. I can't think of a president in a long time.
The day-to-day operation, you know, Trump opines endlessly. You know, you put him in any kind of a setting where there's a camera and people, he'll start talking and start answering questions, and that's new and different. So,
well, but it's also, you have to be real careful. I mean, I think as much as we argue on the show, most people come to this show, and if they have an opinion, they've at least researched it. They can tell you why. We seem to have somebody who doesn't so much care about that, but I mean, I think what I find, John, in this whole, whether you're left, right, or in the barrel, the people who have these kinds of opinions, you know, even the dude Friday night, I mean, and again, he's a nice guy. He's got a 4-year college degree, John. How does he not know that an executive order is not a letter? Does anybody anywhere along the line take remedial civics anymore?
Well, I had it in fourth grade.
Me too.
That's the last civics course I think I took, at least it called itself that.
But you remembered it.
Well, yeah. And the other half of the semester I remember was the history of Chicago, which I loved. Stuff I never knew about.
Well, that was our first history class at St. John Fisher, History of Chicago.
Yeah.
It was next year. We went to history.
Textbooks that, you know, they had a Catholic tilt to them, of course. It was also the history of the Chicago Archdiocese and the church. But it was overlapped in, I thought, you know, a pretty, you know, clear and interesting way. So it wasn't just religious inculcation at all. But it was full of illustrations, and it was, you know, the teachers seemed to be pretty up on it. I mean, you could ask them questions, and you'd get answers that I thought at the time were satisfactory. And my parents had the same kind of thing in their day, too, school system. You know, that's important stuff, and I must say, in high school, I didn't have anything quite like that. And I mean, you have to take a Constitution test, you know, to get your diploma. I don't know if you still do. Probably do.
We didn't have to do that. We had history. We had South American history 1 year. We had European 1 year. I think we had U.S. 1 year. Every year was a different part of the globe, I think.
Oh yeah, we had geography. You know, was like I say, every year was a continent, and you get it deep in the weeds in some of these continents that, you know, nobody was too sure about what was going on, and the maps were changing constantly. I remember by the time we finished the year on Africa, I think that was sixth grade or something.
I remember
pretty different.
Jimmy's a little younger, but I remember the in history class they used to have these. Well, the maps were, you put them up on this, what did you call that? Was almost like an easel, but it was for big charts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, something that you could see in the class. God, you're kicking my memory here, John. I remember we had one of the classes was in history. I don't know, it was Europe or Middle East or some damn place. And the charts were probably, what do you even call those things? It had the two heavy things on the top. There probably were 40 pages of big charts in this thing. I think it weighed 10 pounds, right? I mean, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And they would start, and the first one would be, you know, map of Europe in Roman times, you know, or something along those lines, and you discuss that for a while. Then they'd flip the page, and it was like map of Europe, like 400, you know, AD or something, and then talk about that, all the different changes. And by the when you got to the end, you made it to the Europe or whatever it was in 1970. And you'd go through the change in maps, and it's absolutely, it was fascinating when you think about it. Even to go back, I wish I had some of those in the office. I'd go through them again because they were so illusionary, weren't they?
Oh yeah, I mean, even the good textbooks had like color coded maps, always in the same position, right or left in the book, and you'd go through chapters and it would have like the changing European map after this period of Napoleonic Wars, and it would be color coded to show what had changed on the map. You know, 2 pages earlier or 2 pages later, and everything's, you know, clearly labeled, and it would show you shifting boundaries. All of a sudden, new countries would emerge out of nowhere, and other ones would just, you know, be subsumed into others. And I thought it was a pretty dynamic, you know, picture. Well, you really needed pictures to explain it. You couldn't visualize this stuff without some kind of visual aid. And, you know, there's probably more of that style now in textbooks, but that's to sort of compensate for the quality of the writing and the accompanying material, which I think has just become just pretty laughable the way what I've seen. So it was, you know, very good wedding of visual aids and pretty strong textual material. It's not to say everything we read was absolutely correct. But wasn't supposed to be. But it was definitely informative, and it kept you interested. And I didn't have any trouble in any history or geography class because I thought it was, you know, fascinating stuff. I don't even think geography is taught anymore.
Oh, I doubt it. I mean, why would you? Why would you want to know where Africa is?
Gentlemen, that is a very good point. I was having dinner with my dad, and we had overheard a table behind us. Now, I grew up in New Jersey, and this guy goes...
I wouldn't say that too loud.
Ha-ha. Well, in geography and in maps, as you were discussing, it was one of the 13 colonies well before Illinois was even founded.
Oh, yeah.
But we had heard a table, and the guy's like, yeah, you know, I went to the Jersey Shore up north. Well, anybody from New Jersey, when you say Jersey Shore, it means the south of Jersey.
Right.
And I just thought to myself, this guy has no idea about anything. I bet you if you ask him to pick a map and no lines and ask him where Washington, D.C. is, he'd probably pick the middle of the country.
Oh, yeah. Isn't there a... Isn't that sort of a trick question if you ask there were 13 colonies or 12, was it either, there really were only 12 colonies or 12 original states or something? That's a trick, the 13 is a trick number, isn't it?
Yeah, there's the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Right, and Maine was not a state, it was actually part of Massachusetts.
Yeah, it was something like that, yeah.
Right.
Later on, when the states were developed.
And I thought somebody else, Delaware, was
Delaware part of somebody. Was the first state, so no, Delaware actually was a colony.
Yeah, I remember reading this once, and you could make a, if it's the last question for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or whatever it was, it'd be a trick question, which was 12, the colonies or the states or something. But anywho, I don't know, I was actually read this thing on Quora of all places, and they talked about, did Churchill think that Truman was an idiot, because, you know, Churchill had that huge, was he Oxford Gen or he was someplace, wasn't he? You know, there was a story, and talk about, well, I'm going to butcher this, someplace somewhere, somebody had a sick kid, and they couldn't do anything for him, and the doctor came by and helped the kid out, and the kid's, either it was Churchill's dad, or the kid was Churchill or something. And 40 years later, they did something, the turnaround, they didn't even know that they knew each other, and they did something for the other guy's son that saved him or something. Some amazing trick in history. It might have been Churchill who was a sickly kid, and the doctor did something to help him, and then he turned around and did something for the other guy, for that guy's kid that didn't even know that was the guy who saved him's son. Some bizarre history story. I mean, you know, a small world story, but anyway, the answer was, first of all, Truman wasn't an idiot. That during the 1920s, primary education, even in rural areas in the U.S., was amazingly strict, and he was a voracious reader. He probably read as much as Churchill. They were equals from day one mentally, and I would never have thought that, honestly. But I remember my family. I mean, they've all been dead forever, but they, none of them, except for my mother and my aunt, got out of high school. Yeah, you could talk to them on every subject, and one was a tool and die maker, became an installer of printing presses, could read every blueprint, all that kind of stuff, and read the contracts. You'd never guess the guy didn't make it out of high school. But they never stopped learning. I mean, I would do this if a guy like Flanagan were to have one of my weak points, if I was ever in a debate somewhere, I would love to see what happened to the whole Middle East after the Ottoman Empire blew up in the 1913s and 15s or 20s, wherever it was, when Churchill and T.E. Lawrence and those guys, as to who got what and how these borders were all put together, because I think you could write a chart now of a lot of things that were wrong in the world, and they all date back to that. And I just love to have, you know, maybe 10 hours of instruction on what exactly happened and who did what and who the players were. I mean, we talk about these places, and Lou knows more, obviously, than I do, but I don't really, It's not like we're talking about Wyoming, aren't we? I mean, it's
no.
I mean, you what do you feel your knowledge is of that, of all that stuff, John? It's probably higher than mine, but on a scale of 1 to 10, where are you? I think I'm a 1.
Yeah, and you know, it's sort of been subsumed into you know the popular entertainment, like Lawrence of Arabia, which I think for most people is the first time any of this was really talked about or visualized. It, because it was already, by the 1960s, it had sort of faded into the distant past. And that's a particular tilt on it, that gave, people working knowledge of the period and the geography, but it doesn't come close to, explaining it, how tumultuous and how, shattering the events down the road would be because of what, came out of that struggle. And you read T.E. Lawrence, and you get a feel for what his various axes to grind were, and then you look at the other side of it, and it's clearly portrayed in the movie, that he's the outlier. The Brits want none of what he wants at all. He's seeing this as some kind of crusade for the nomadic tribes, which nobody in British intelligence or in politics, had any interest in pursuing that. So it was about keeping
him. There's basically, this is not intended to be funny, it's a bunch of guys running around on camels in the desert. And then there's areas where it had some cities, and the French locked in more on them, but as to how people locked in on different areas and what the role of the French Foreign Legion was and all this, I mean, there's a history there that maybe we ought to know before we start opining on all this stuff.
It was highly romanticized, by both sides, and fictionalized now too. So it's pretty hard to get to any kind of a common understanding about what the objectives really were. And
this is before oil was even found, right?
Correct.
Yeah,
because oil.
This goes back to the old trade routes. It goes back to the Crusades. I mean, this is the same territory that was being squabbled over, and you had it against the backdrop of World War One, where all of the bigger players were being consumed in the trenches, and the empires falling and new ones created.
Well, John, what happened? Or Jimmy, because Jimmy actually knows a lot of this stuff. He's Mr. History. I know that at the end of World War One, somewhere along in there, the Ottoman Empire, which had been a major player in the world for zillions of centuries, all of a sudden just was kaput. What happened there? Did somebody actually conquer them and knock everybody out of government? Or, how did they even... They just felt like a rock and there was nothing left?
Well, they felt like the Habsburgs fell. I mean, you had basically the colonization earlier, 50 years earlier, of Africa. That's why the British at that point in time were in Egypt. The Turks at that point went and backed the Germans.
Well, the Turks were part of the Ottoman Empire.
They went, the falling empire backed the Germans in World War One. When it fell, the guy named Ataturk, who is now the founder of modern Turkey, became, turned it into what we know as modern Turkey today.
Was he the guy who slaughtered all the Armenians?
No, it was one of the sultans. But the problem is, and John has, inferences, is the Ottoman Empire itself really didn't have territories. It was most of modern Turkey. It was bordering Iran, and then it went down. It actually never went into the Saudi Arabia Peninsula at all.
Well, they were a non-factor.
They were the Bedouins.
Yeah, they were just a bunch of guys, like I said, that sounds horrible, running around camels in the sand.
Right. And
Before oil.
And what we know as the Middle East, Damascus, Jerusalem, Alexandria, Constantinople, or now Istanbul, were actually functioning cities for thousands of years. They had been around. And then you get the British and the French saying, well, you got to have lines. And so how they did it, nobody really knows, but they drew a couple of lines and said, okay, these are the countries. And they did the same with Iran, with the Iran-Turkish border.
Yeah, how'd that work out?
Exactly, which was part of Armenia, and they decided, Armenia, I don't know if they should exist, not exist, or the Kurds, so they were left out. But it happens when you have a bunch of people said, well, okay, we need lines.
Well, if you had to put your finger on a date, when did the Discovery Oil start to totally mess us? So I know this Discovery Oil was a British guy in Iran. He thought there was oil there, and it took him forever.
I would say roughly just after the war, about 1919, 1921, is when they really found it. And yes, Iran was one of the first places.
Because at Versailles, when everybody left the table, I know this was in the book Freedom from Fear, was it 90 or 95% of all known oil reserves were on one side of the table? But I don't think that included the Saudi and Iran and stuff, did it, Jen?
No.
Because I don't think people knew there was oil there.
Right.
How did the Saudis not know they had oil? Wasn't it gurgling out of the sand in some spots?
It wasn't until the Western people got in there. It probably was boiling out of the ground, but they didn't know what it was.
It's something to stay away from.
Exactly.
I mean, when I was reading this book about this discovery of oil in the Middle East, I'd have blown the million-dollar question. I would have said Saudi, but it was Iran. Which, you know, again, I would not have... but, I mean, there's a history kind of to all this stuff that really... it's fascinating, but it's... I mean, the whole history of the world for the whole way through, John, it's kind of a lot for one person to know, right?
Yeah.
But...
what was not, you know, really on the horizon at the time of the end of World War One? I mean, that had always been a really super sensitive part of the world since, you know, building the Suez Canal, and before that too, just as you know, a meeting of cultures. But it was fairly recent in the European understanding. I mean, nobody knew really anything about the Sphinx in Egypt or any of these things until the time of Napoleon. It was not something people could, you know, could tell you anything about if they'd ever even heard of it. And all that changed within 100 years or so. But you had this kind of crazy confluence of politics and, you know, drawing of national boundaries, and then you lay oil on top of it, and, you know, the importance of trade through these, you know, highly contested areas, and always being contested for different things by different people or different governments, it became a hotbed that I don't think anybody really had a handle on in 1990 at all. Nobody saw the bigger picture, certainly.
Well, when you see the struggle going on in the Middle East and Israel's fight with all these people, I actually read an article from somebody, Jan, talking about how, and again, you know, he's pointing out years of history that I don't know what the hell he was talking about, but basically he was talking about, you know, 30 and 40 and 50 year, even 100 year times when everybody in that area, a lot of Muslims, a lot of, I guess we'd call them Palestinians because they were there, and Jewish people all sort of got along in that area. And then, you know, the 48 thing happened, and they started to separate everybody. They said there's way more conflict now than before. I don't know if that's true or not, but everybody kind of got along. I mean, to the extent that anybody ever gets along. But, you know, now the idea that this area is our area and this is yours over there, is that for centuries that really wasn't the case. I mean, that's why you have, you know, Jewish, Catholic, and essentially Muslim areas in Jerusalem. They're all sacred to all three, right? They were all living there. I'm sure that's a much more, you know, stylized view of the place, but I mean, his point was, I mean, do the Israelis, why can't they just, at some point you had, you know, Palestinians and Israelis living together, and it was better than it is now. I don't want to say it was okay, but yeah, I don't know, you read about this stuff and you wonder why does this guy, I mean, right now I don't see how the hell, I mean, I see the Israelis, you know, for the next however many years, certainly prevailing, but I don't know how you'd prevail for 500 years if every country around you is a disaster. Somehow or another, if you're going to live in peace, Lebanon has to be a real place, Syria has to be a real place, even if they don't agree with you. And I mean, they're a different religion. Now, the Muslims are big on, you know, conquering for religion in some areas. I mean, somehow that's got to get fixed. Or are we going to be going through this 50 years from now, or where am I wrong?
No, that's kind of, I think, what eventually sunk the Ottoman Empire, among other things. But it was such a fractious amalgamation of cultures and religions and histories without a strong ruler or any kind of government structure in any of these outlying places that could keep warring factions, you know, from blowing each other up, hitting each other at the drop of a hat, and that, you know, was, you know, pretty much discredited as a governmental structure by the time World War One ended. And that's same thing with the Habsburgs, but it was an awful amalgamation of, you know, Christians and Muslims and other, you know, subsects of these various faiths, for one thing, and that's never been completely harmonious, and there's no expectation why it ever will be now, any more than it is, you know, any place you can point to, really. There's very little religious harmony now, and it's because the religions have felt they're all fighting some kind of a death struggle against each other, as, you know, the secular world seems to be the
well, I mean, look at the example. There's not much different between, you know, ripping Saddam Hussein off the top of Iraq, you know, he wasn't a good guy at all, is what happened in Yugoslavia, right?
Right.
I mean, you rip the guy off, you know he's a crook, and all of a sudden, hey, look, the people under him don't get along. Well, duh. I mean, you know...
That was a pretty, you know, it took somebody like Marshal Tito to make it work at all. And of course, the older he got...
Yeah, which doesn't mean you want a Marshal Tito hanging around, but...
No, or that you can, you know, have any kind of a structure that somebody will inherit and keep the whole thing going in the same kind of way. And he was, you know, benevolent by, you know, standards of you know, rulers of a totalitarian state compared to a lot of other places. But even so, it was not something that could continue. And we saw that unraveling, you know, in our own lifetimes. You know, and the mess in Kosovo and Bosnia, and all these, you know, countries that people had learned not to pay too much attention to when Yugoslavia held sway, all of a sudden now, you know, endless, you know, sectional strife and, you know, geopolitical realignment over it. The same thing, you know, that put the Yugoslavia together eventually pulled it apart, and we're kind of dealing in the aftermath of that too, which is, you know, still got its problems, certainly.
You know, Jen, I think a lot of this, and we had our buddy Dr. Blade on, a lot of this is somehow or another part of, God, I hope, you know, shooting people isn't, but part of human nature. And it's, and there's, as you know, there's people of all kinds of different cloth, right? Well, on a very peaceful view like that, I mean, for those that don't, years ago, PTI used to clear through Mesro, and we had a terrific relationship with those people. And I was personal friend of the guy who ran it, a guy named Jim Tyree. And Jimmy died, unfortunately, too young. And when he did, the place, we ended up over at RBC, which is fine, but our home was at Mesro. I mean, we were just tight with everybody there. It was a natural match. And but Jimmy was a guy that he pretty much saved Marist High School. He was a big benefit.
At least prolonged the life of the Sun Times, too.
Yeah, yeah. And but he was a guy that if you sat down talking to him, the entire world revolved around you. The rest of the room disappeared. And there's only a few people that I've ever been in a conversation with that have done the same thing. You know who else was like that, Jen? Carol Moseley Braun had that personality. I mean, she didn't get to mess up with the boyfriend or whatever was going on there, but she was one of those people that just, when she locked on a conversation with you, it was like the rest of the room disappeared. All she cared about was talking to you, and you could just feel it. And how many people do you know that are like that? You always get the feeling they're thinking about something else and whatever, not you. And
thinking of anything but you.
Yeah, thinking of anything but you, even though they're standing there getting a photo op with you. But one of the dudes that worked there, and they were involved in insurance and the commercial side. They did a lot of airplane insuring and stuff you wouldn't even dream of. They have probably five or six divisions. And one of the guys that told me about this, he goes, Jimmy was never afraid to have the strongest person in every one of those spots. He said the only fly in the oil was the only guy who controlled any of these guys, they were so independent and so driven, was Jimmy. He said he was the only one that could sit in a room and these guys would all get along because he was there. He's the most quiet guy you ever came across, the nicest guy, but he was the alpha dog in the room. And they said if everything ever happened to him, these other guys, they couldn't order lunch without fighting. And sure enough, that's kind of what happened. I mean, but some people have the ability to keep very, very talented, driven, maybe flawed people moving in the same direction, and other people don't. You know, and it's actually a very rare talent, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
That's why people end up, we have, to be honest, I think at most, both ends of our political world, a mayor and a president that do not have that talent. So they have to put people around them that are essentially yes men. That would drive me nuts, John. If every time I had an idea, the guy told it back to me, I'd say, what do I need you for? In a city, I mean, what would you say the ratio is for Johnson? You know, an ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of talent or more? I mean, is that fair? I mean, to say, I mean, it's a criticism, I know, but does it, if you're not out of his group, out of, you know, some sort of a activist or something, you know, you're not in, are you?
Well, that's the method of somebody who doesn't have, you know, enough personal appeal to expose him or herself to the public regularly and to take the heat and to come out looking like you've, you know, salvaged something and people respect you for, you know, wielding your power the way you do. But, and, you know, somebody like Brandon Johnson has lost that if he ever had it. And the substitute is to get, you know, enough people in the city council of whatever stripe to sort of run interference for him.
Yeah.
And to keep the same, you know, agenda foremost in their minds and think that they know more than everybody else and certainly act as if they do. But that is not, you know, recipe for anything than what we have now. You know, the city is, you know, in dire straits financially, let's put it that way.
Well, that's our buddy Brendan, who, you know, fortunately had some health issues, and maybe one of these days he'll come back, but he was very involved in city finances, and he said that Lori Lightfoot, you know, despite the fact that she was pretty thin-skinned and had some issues, because the people she hired for city finance were terrific. She actually made a lot of progress during her term in city finances. But nobody would, once you didn't like her, you would never even cut her that slack. He said, but the truth is, she didn't have any problem hiring really good people there, and she didn't care what color they were. Which you would never guess, right? By watching her on TV.
Oh.
I think the difference in ability and in knowledge between her and Johnson is light years, don't you?
Well, I mean, she had a real, you know, a job for her term as mayor. She wasn't, you know, a political figure other than, you know, that she had worked within the, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office and had, you know, friends and advisors who at one time I think she did trust and listen to, and she kind of lost all those people. It's kind of like what happened to Jane Byrne in a way, too.
Yeah.
Where she it became about survival rather than about, you know, leading from a point of strength.
Well, my buddy Bill says that she was very competent in her job, and she was tough to go into court against.
Yeah, and I mean Johnson had, you know, what, you know, the term was a teacher three
yeah,
years.
Yeah, teacher. Half a minute,
and bragged later on about how he never had time or interest in teaching. It was all about listening to students' stories.
But he's going to get a pension.
Yeah, that's okay if you're a social worker.
Yeah.
If you're sending kids to school to learn something, you don't want your teacher just saying, "Tell me your story."
Well, so that's I don't. I mean, these are kind of the you know, some of the gripes between the left and the right that are really. It may strike you as odd, John, but when I spend some time with people that are very progressive, or whatever you want to call them, I bitch just as much as them as I do with you guys on the right. I just want stuff to work. I don't care what name is on top of it. I mean, when I was talking to somebody who's, you know, talking about the school system, and I said, you know, if the Democratic Party is ever going to want to win again, I mean, hell, if you can't beat Trump, something's wrong with you. And I said, you have to understand that the school situation, people are paying whatever the number is, 21,000 a student, 22,000 a student, and people see that at the end of high school, you know, you have some terrific high schools in Chicago, you have these magnet schools and everything, so I'm not tiring everybody. So, but the fact is, a real lot of these people can't read. I'm not talking about one color, I'm just saying a real lot of these people can't read. There's no any kind of education, and a lot of stuff Kevin does, and you know, any kind of a, I mean, there's no shame in going to welding school or carpentry school while you're in college. I mean, Audrey says she went to Kelly, which is a public school. She had every pretty much known craft, electric, whatever it was. Then there was the college placement. There were guys that were in both. I said, you got to understand, who was I talking to? It was John Lee's niece. I said, you have to understand that the message to the rest of the world is if you just make the money $25,000 instead of $22,000, that will solve all the problem. And the problem is not enough money. I said, you have to understand, look me right in the eye. No one believes that. No one believes that. And she looked at me like, what do you mean? I said, nobody believes that. Nobody believes that you want your daughter playing with some guy in high school. Nobody who owns a building wants they have to put in a third bathroom for people who haven't decided yet. Nobody wants that crap. And she's looking at me like I'm to the right of Donald Trump. John, that's just common sense. Nobody wants that. And they want their money to be spent. They don't mind coming up with some dough for education. That's America. They want it to be spent well. They want to see people coming out of there, getting a job, having a trade, becoming part of society, paying taxes like everybody else. It's not happening. I mean, where am I wrong? I mean, the answer on, I mean, both sides arguing isn't solving anything, I don't think.
Well, just this past weekend at its national meeting, the AFT, American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten's outfit, came up with this announcement that they're now partnering with the World Economic Forum for curriculum development. I mean, this would be, I guess, laughable to most people, that regardless of your political alignment, but the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, you want that outfit, having any input in the teaching curriculum. What do you think it's going to say about the U.S., any of that curriculum? It's going to be bashing the U.S. nine ways to Sunday. And this is, she's touting it like it's some great breakthrough. And now all of a sudden people are going to start to learn in their schools, because we've got this partnership. It's like, man, I've lived too long.
Well, John, why can't we, if our problem in a lot of, some of the neighborhoods are, we're, people didn't necessarily learn by the time they were 18. Why does the school have to shut down at 3 o'clock? Why does it have to shut down
in the summer?
Yeah, well, supposedly everybody get a break and kids can have a regular job. Of course, I don't know if he gets that anymore, does that anymore. But,
or why is it the full summer? I mean, I think a month.
It's nowhere near full summer anymore. These guys go back in August. And one of those vacation retreats in the Poconos, you'd be on the other side of this argument. But anyway, I'm saying, what about if some of the mothers don't know what the kids are learning in fifth grade, why not have a couple mothers in the back of the class? Why can't there be a class or two at night for the parents that don't know what the kids are learning? Why can't, if you're 25 and you want to learn how to read a drawing or you want to know some basic math, why can't the school's closed? I mean, it's the center of the community, for God's sake. I mean, somewhere along the line, you got to catch up here, or else you got a whole generation of people that don't know anything. I mean, there needs to be some thinking outside the box here. And the investment has to be, I would try five or six different programs, Jen, not much money. And by the way, the ones that don't work, bleep can them, and the ones that work, go on, son. And I mean, we don't try anything. We just bitch back and forth and need more money. What does that solve?
Well, if you let the market, such as we have a market in education, actually operate freely, you'd have opportunities for experimentation. You'd have, a hands-off attitude. If you want to try this in this local school district, if you want to try it in this local school, go at it. We're not going to kill you with oversight. We're not going to be meddling at every step of the way. We're not really here to destroy you, although that's really what happens to any kind of experimentation in the school system we have. There's no room for it. There's no, applause for it. There's no respect for it. So when you have experimentation driven out of the whole formula, you get what you've got now in spades, which is just, awful education with teachers who don't show up, and therefore students who don't show up, and you got people inflating grades and, lying about enrollment numbers and dickering around with budgets to prove, just what a great job they're doing, and the numbers don't support that in any shape or form, but the system just lumbers on anyway, and nobody is able to stop it.
Why could you have walked into some classroom in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s and have everybody pretty much doing what they're supposed to be doing, and now you don't? Is it kids are all drugged up? Is it the parents don't care? The dreaded call home, nobody answers the phone, there is no phone at home? I mean, what is the difference? Is it the schools screw up first or the families screw up first?
Well, the schools, I think, started it because they became enamored of their own importance and took a kind of cavalier attitude to the families, you know, the importance of education in the home, let alone in the bigger body politic. And it was all about sort of stroking their own egos and making their job easier and easier all the time. That's the problem I see it in the teaching business. Of course, there are still committed teachers, and you know, all of them are swimming upstream, as far as I can tell, because the prevailing culture is, you know, do as little as possible to not make the situation that we've got any worse. Because you know, certainly any kind of like going against the grain or exposing just how corrupt and misspent, you know, the budgets are would be suicide for an administrator or a teacher. That culture has become absolutely tyrannical, and it's because they've been allowed to get away with some, you know, corruption and some lack of results, that now that's the norm. So, you know, nobody cares about, you know, performance. Nobody cares about things other than just keeping the bodies in the seats and making sure that you meet your budget for that year. And that's a recipe for failure that's never going to turn around without, you know, blowing the whole thing up.
Well, two quick stories on the bottom end, and both of them for a while ago. One is my sister-in-law had a birthday this week. Nice lady. She does a lot of work for historical societies and stuff. Very, very bright lady. I mean, in fact, she works with some benefactor lady doing historical society stuff in New York. I mean, place I don't even know. But anyway, she took a shot at being a substitute teacher in a Chicago school. This has got to be. Wow, we were young. I don't think the kids were born yet. But and the teacher, now, we all came from a Catholic school background, which, you know, maybe had its flaws. But the overhead, let's put it this way, overhead was not one of the flaws, Jen. There was like no overhead, right? Everybody was a teacher. If a teacher called in sick, the principal taught class, right? So she came from that background. So she gets a call from the public schools where evidently they used to teach sex education for a week. Well, that's, I don't know, the whole week, but that's the week the teachers would always, like, take off or call in sick or do something, which I never dreamed how a teacher would not show up, because they were always there in class before I got there. And so she said there was always a couple of kids in class that were, you know, causing trouble, and you couldn't really do much with them. So she said, I resorted to the dreaded call home, which, you know, was the last thing a teacher would want to do, because the parents either beat the crap out of the kid or he wouldn't see the light of day for a month. So they call home. Nobody, this is back when people had home phones. Nobody'd answer, or some guy would answer the phone, and he's the live-in boyfriend. Not my kid, I don't care, slam. She couldn't believe it. Total different world than what she was brought up in. I'm sure that's only sort of gotten worse. And then Audrey, we had this dinner with the doctor and his daughter, and she brings one of her friends. She's teaching on the South Side. This is 15 years ago. And she goes, well, you know, a lot of the money we're spending for, like, pencils and stuff, I'm buying. She goes, but everybody in class, 75% of them are on some kind of drug. If they take their drug, they're asleep on the desk. If they don't, they're bouncing off the walls. And I never know what I'm going to find any day because everybody's drugged. And I'm like, nobody had to deal with that when we were young, John. I mean, there were always some people with ants in their pants, but you dealt with it, right?
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, you did something. You had a recess, or kids have always been kids. Why all of a sudden do we have such a horrible job dealing with kids? I mean, I don't get it. I mean, the thing I went Saturday night, you know, like I said, there's a real lot of Hispanic families there. All of them had kids. I didn't hear anybody crying. I didn't hear anybody doing anything. There was grandmothers. Everybody was in charge of, like, one kid at one time for the whole game. I didn't see anybody doing anything wrong. I mean, it was amazing. You know, it's all very generational. How did we somewhat lose all that?
Well, you know, the welfare culture, you know, certainly had, you know, disproportionate effect on African Americans starting in the 60s. And things like Head Start that were designed to sort of counteract what was seen as, you know, educational failure, was not enough to kind of keep, you know, the family together. The, you know, the word family has come to mean something, you know, kind of antique or almost laughable when you think about, you know, most of the culture that kids today know. There's no stability among the parents. There's usually, you know, not two parents, at least not the same two parents for very long. And you're lucky if you have two parents at any time, because the norm is pulling in the other direction. And you know, you mentioned, you know, the kids all drugged up today. That's a function of, you know, the pharmaceutical industry and physicians thought they could give families some kind of coping mechanism because raising a family had become too difficult if you're trying to hold down a job because you only have one breadwinner in the family. And the kid's driving you nuts, so what do? You drug the kid. So it's not surprising that, you know, all of these palliative measures to kind of make it possible for people to cope have, you know, turned the situation into something where there's no learning going on, there's no discipline, there's no recipe for anything other than more of the same and more money all the time. And of course, the educational product has been completely lost in the shuffle.
Well, John, we only have a couple of minutes, but maybe we should go through it next week. A lot of it was anticipated by smart people. I mean, I bring up the name Otto Kerner all the while, but he was in charge of something called the Kerner Commission. And he basically said that policies of the time were creating a permanent subclass. And other than throwing a guy in jail, did anybody believe him? Did anybody even read the thing?
Well, that was the message nobody wanted people to really stop and think about.
But was the guy right or not? I mean, well, for God's sake.
Absolutely right. And this is early on.
This is 1970?
The Great Society is before that. You know, I think the report came out in late 69. It came out not long after the upheaval of 1968.
And the response was to throw him in jail. Right?
Yeah, well, and that's, you know, that was not the message that Democrats were looking for. Because it really, you know, it had the seeds in it of telling, you know, minorities too, you're not really, you know,
wasn't that Nixon
part of any big solution here? You're just, you know, you're going to be brought along for the ride, and you're going to be expected to adhere to some political doctrine in your localities. But, you know, forget it. It's an underclass. It's you know, you're never going to.
Yeah, was that a Johnson deal or was that Nixon?
Well, I think, you know, the commission started maybe after Nixon was president.
After Nixon?
Yeah, it was an outgrowth of the riots of April of 68. And, you know, Nixon was president in July 69, or January 69, sorry. So, yeah, it was released, I think, after Nixon had come into office. And, of course, you know, Nixon, when you look back on it, and some of his circle, like, you know, Daniel Patrick Moynihan and the idea of benign neglect, you know, for American cities. It just, you know, the culture seemed to be leave it alone.
But he was put in jail by Thompson, who was a Republican, so you can't really blame it on the Democrats.
No. And that's, you know, the Republicans at that time were looking for, you know, low-hanging fruit, pretty much, anywhere they could to, you know, kind of dismantle what was, you know, happening in big cities and in Illinois at the time, too. So it was party time for the Republicans for one or two terms.
Well, people in those days, we got to go to break here and get Nancy in, but people, some guys at the Evergreen Baptist Tennis, when I say my club, it wasn't a club. One guy was talking to me, he was a social whatever, an older dude, well, he's an older at the time, but the whole idea of like Cabrini Green and Robert Taylor Holmes, that had already been tried in New York, and the conclusion was it was a total disaster. And the conclusions were already out before we built them here. What do you say we do a very quick break, come back and grab Nance? SP Futures up 11, Nance Futures up 33, back in like 2 seconds.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
We're back.
The, John, Nance, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing fine. When are you leaving out to go see the Bears training camp today?
I'm not.
You're one of these fanatic kind of people.
No, I'm not fanatic. I just like them.
All right, well.
I just like football. I like a good football game. If they can prove, if they can at least get that much, that's fine. If they break every rule of decent football logic, I can't watch.
It's like in other words, like watching the Sox the last few years, but now they're getting better.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, just 3 and out, quarterback gets smashed. 3 and out, miss the punt. I mean, who wants to watch that?
I guess it's entertaining. Somewhat.
I don't know.
On some level.
Yeah, I don't know for who, the other team.
Well, the Sox bring up this. I watched the guy play shortstop, and they finally got a good guy. So, like Jimmy was saying earlier, then they put the guy at third base, and he basically screws up the game for me. Has he even played third base before, Jimmy? You think? Or what is with that idea?
He did not. They put him. It's a recent move.
Yeah.
Now you would think most infielders know the rules, but apparently he didn't.
Well, so Nance, what's going on in your world? What's the John, another big building downtown bit the dust and went through foreclosure? Was that last week? A week before? Somebody, I keep getting this stuff from Cranes. There doesn't seem to be any comeback there yet. One of the dudes that was at my brother's yesterday, he's an iron worker, and he's working on some new building over in the West Loop to put up some 32-story place. Is that phenomenon? I don't get that whole thing, but somehow. Anyway, Nance, you start with the retail part, and then we'll try and zero in on what's going on in the commercial part. What's going on in the retail world? Any mortgages?
It's a little bit busier. It is a little bit busier, but there's no consistency to what I'm seeing. I mean, I think this is a run-up. I'm curious to see what's going to happen in August and September. I wonder if it's going to continue or be dead. Or could August just be a stall because, kids go back to college, people focus on other things, and then September, it'll ignite again. It'll be interesting to see what really happens. But I'm hearing less and less that the rates are going to come down. I'm hearing more like, I'm not leaving my 2.8% mortgage. You can just forget that.
That doesn't shock you, does it?
Oh, God, no. I mean, seriously, it's the best interest for everyone for people to stay at their lower rate. I mean, who wouldn't do that if they could?
Is there any other than divorces or company moving people? By the way, do companies buy houses for anybody anymore if they transfer them, or is that a dead dog?
I think if you're if it's a worldwide company, if it's somebody really big, but for the most part, I don't really hear of that anymore at all.
So you're sort of on your own.
Yeah, I believe so. I really do, but I don't want to give people absolutely no hope. But I think, a big company may, but for the most part, all these perks that would have considered to be perks at one time are gone. I mean, people just, there's no money being offered to anyone unless they absolutely have to. There's so many cutbacks across in the different industries. It's crazy.
Layoffs,
hospitals.
Layoffs been a factor, or not yet, or coming, or not coming, or like the people, Microsoft and all those kind of places are laying off.
I have seen some layoffs. I really have. And then I don't know. It's a mixed bag of what's going on out there. So that's what I'm saying. It's the next couple of months will probably sort it out. You can't really say one trend is really picking up over another right now.
If you had to make a stab over your last 100 mortgages, how many of them can be financed by one person in the family working instead of two?
I don't think any.
Wow.
I don't think
I thought any. You were going to say like 25%. I didn't think you'd say none.
No, everyone's working. I mean, literally everyone is
working. So if one person gets laid off, it's a problem. I mean, a big problem.
Well, I can't say that, but they'll definitely have to cut back. But the average mortgage payment right now, I think, is about $3,200.
Well,
that's, you know, and I mean, from our era, that's a lot of money.
Well, Aud was saying the average price in Orland is up 16% this year or something. Is she right about that? I'm sure she is.
That was a 10-foot pole. I'm sure she is. I mean, I know that the average home goes up 8% per year, so it's possible. There's not a lot on the market still.
Jen, what are you opining on all this? What are you thinking?
Well, I still think that, you know, the high-end residential properties are, you know, still, you know, they're coming on the market, they're selling fairly quickly, you know, or the prices are getting bid up. And that inflates the median sales price, I think, quite a bit, because there's nothing really that I can see that's balancing it at the low end, where you've got properties that, you know, a first-time home buyer can afford, even if the prices are, you know, what we would consider attractive in the kind of market we've got. So, you know, to get $250,000 house, you know, is going to mean repairs that the average first-time home buyer has no ability to pay for and will doesn't want to get involved with, and perhaps losing the property over not keeping it up or not being able to afford keeping it up.
Ben, what are you thinking is high-end?
I'm sorry?
What number do you think is high-end?
Oh, I think, you know, say above, what, you know, 500,000, 600,000.
Okay, because the average price I'm seeing right now for first-time homebuyers is around 380.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying, I've had, I think, three in the past month that have purchased, and they all said they didn't want to go over, you know, 300. They thought they could get 275 to 300, maybe 325, and they all bought at 380.
And that's below the national median, but, you know,
what is the national median?
That's a 460 the last time.
Yeah, it's up to four, middle fours.
Wow.
So I and as you say, and I completely agree. You know, you can't afford a mortgage for a low end house as a single, you know, breadwinner. It's not going to, I think, work for anybody these days. So, especially when you factor in things like child care or transportation costs and everything else, and insurance, and, you know, the bill just goes on and on. But the people who are doing okay are at the higher end, where they can, you know, pay cash for a house. They don't have to worry about interest rates.
You know? Yeah, they're not necessarily doing okay. They're selling another house.
Yeah, they're selling another house. Yeah. So they're, the recent move, I don't know if you saw this, but Stephen Moore, who was, you know, one of Trump's advisors, he may still be, but he came out, you know, the other day, you know, on indexing capital gains, for real estate. And Trump has talked about, you know, getting rid of capital gains for residential properties. This is something that, you know, it certainly needs to be looked at, because it really is a drag on the market. You know, it's people are getting dinged by inheriting property, or, you know, or taking over something. When they're boxed in, they have to buy something, and they're forced to buy something that isn't as good as the thing that they're getting rid of. So, I think that would be one place where there's room for improvement in the way people are lured into putting their house on the market and getting interested in buying another one to replace it. Right now, I don't see any tax advantage to doing that for most people.
Well, what a lot two things at you. And again, it's not market timing or whatever, but back in 2007, I did a study on amount of people's income. I didn't. I found a study and from somebody, and I read it and discussed it with various people, male and female. You know what I'm talking about, Nance? And had to do with how many people, what percentage of people in society could afford the median home. At the time, the median homes were, I'm going to say 270, and it was like 15% of the people could afford the median home. And that's not so hot. It's in 2007, and of course, those prices came home to Papa over the next 6 months or year. And the stock market in 1999, the top five or six stocks that were the magnificent five or six at the time, had made it to like 11, 12 times revenue. And then, you know, I'm not saying that's what caused it, my study, all of a sudden the market came home to Papa or came home to someplace. Now, the home prices are in the mid fours, like John is talking about. In those days, the average, the median income was like 30-some thousand. Well, now let's say it's 40, 42. We're way worse off on the numbers than we ever were in 2007. And the stock market, some of the biggest stocks that are in the thing now, the Magnificent Seven, have revenue per share being in the 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 range. Way worse than 1999. Now, in those days, the Fed pulled back on some of the money that they threw in for Y2K, and the market, it was coincidental, maybe with the stuff coming back to a different sort of pricing. Right now, it doesn't look like that's being, you know, stopping at all. Home prices keep going up, despite people's inability to apparently pay for them, except if you sold a house and you traded stuff there, and the market keeps going up every day. There doesn't seem to be any thought whatsoever to, gee, a home price is 460. What percentage of the population can actually afford that? 10%. Well, wait a minute. Isn't that a problem? I mean, these are just the numbers that I do. And, of course, I'm never any good on the timing or never any good on anything. But do you guys, I mean, what's your comment on that? I mean, that's on the real estate side first. The numbers are getting pretty darn high, right? You just said that.
They are. Well, they are. I mean, I'm not saying they aren't. I'm just, there's no... I think you're right in your analysis seems correct. I just don't know what anyone can do about it.
Well, you said the average mortgage, the median mortgage is $3,200. The tax has got to be five, and I'll be probably being nice there.
I'm saying like $3,200 all in with your taxes.
Okay, well, okay. So what after tax? Well, you get to deduct some of the mortgage interest now. What do you have to make on your own to afford that, assuming somebody gives you the 20% down?
Oh, you'd have to at least be making $10,000 a month, $12,000 a month.
All right, so $130,000 a year. What percentage of the population makes $130,000 on their own, on one income?
I'm going to say 10%. It's definitely
10%.
It's definitely two incomes.
Right, now that presupposes other stuff. You're paying for child care, you're paying for two cars to go to work. We're paying for. I mean, it's not. That doesn't come free, does it?
Not that I know of.
No, I mean, John, what do you think? I mean, the market's kind of the same way. This isn't a call to go sell your house or sell your stocks at all. It's just we're in rarefied air, is all I'm saying. And every time we've been there before, something seems to happen. Is that a fair?
I saw this video by, he's a real estate broker in Miami. He lives in California half of the year, and I don't know how much real estate he actually does anymore. But his daily videos, they're like a half hour long, about real estate in his view, close by and elsewhere. An interesting topic the other day, talking about how in a couple markets, new homes are competing with existing homes to first-time home buyers, that the market for new construction is in such dire strait that they want, they're trying to offer buy downs on mortgages to get people in for prices that normally you would expect to pay a lot more for new construction than for pretty much any existing home. And now it's like the home builders can't, you know, do what they used to do, which was to sell, you know, houses for what they actually cost to build, and sell them in enough numbers to make money. Now they're taking a bath in a couple different ways just to move these properties, and you can see it in the latest housing start numbers that I saw, which were really depressed, you know, year over year, let alone like from 10 years ago. And I think that's the trouble in a lot of big markets, where people are not interested in developing land close to, you know, cities that are not able to, you know, attract people to their downtown areas, where people are afraid to go out at night. You're not going to see, you know, big swaths of land being developed to build houses farther away from these centers that are no longer attractive to many people. So the home construction business is going to go to other markets completely, and it's going to bypass older cities like Chicago and New York and Detroit and places like that, where there's no incentive to develop land in numbers like we used to see.
Well, the strange phenomenon that I see, and it's certainly Nance and I know somebody who's remodeling a home, and when there was a statement, I think it was actually almost on the same day that Washington came out with some story about building new homes, and if we just, was it Marco Rubio? Was one of the guys out there said something about we need like a million new homes or something to get the price of the homes down, and then at the same time, talking about people in different sides of the story, Mayor Johnson's talking about building homes for people. And I think for a long period of time, and Nance, kick me if I'm wrong, houses were trading for, I'm going to say, a couple decades. Were in a lot of homes, the houses were trading at way less than the replacement price. I mean, I don't think, Nance, I mean, you got a nice place. I'm going to say, if you sold it tomorrow, I don't think you could put it back up for what you sold it for. And so the idea that it's to me, it's how distant our politicians are on both sides of the aisle from reality. You can't build a home now unless you put absolute crap into the thing. You can't build a home now that's going to be cheap and actually the $400,000 house that Nance is talking about, you can't put that up for $250,000 and sell it at $300,000 and make any money, can you, Nance? What can you build for $250,000? A shack?
You know, I agree with what you said. I also know someone who's rehabbing right now, and the person had one idea of what it was going to cost, and was just the reality of it now is totally nowhere near that number. And this is all do-it-yourself type work. And, you know, we're looking at each other now saying, I don't even know if it was really worth doing it all, right? We won't know until you actually get it finished and you can put it up for sale. But the insurance companies are saying that, you know, my home is worth, to rebuild my home is worth more than what I could sell it for.
Well, sure.
So that kind of answers the question right there. There's just absolutely no way. So to just sit and say, unless they're going to do like what, you know, they did like after World War II, where they just put up homes, they were all the same, you know, there was no variation at all, maybe they could do it something like that. I really don't know.
It's pretty scary when you think about it.
But they're going to be, you know, they have to, I mean, the bigger the home, the worse it gets, right? So I would say, you know, unless they're sticking to homes that are 1,000 square feet, I mean, it's the minimum. That I don't know how they're going to do it. I just don't know. That's a very good question. John, what do you see in the city? Because you live on the north side, right?
Yeah. You know, the properties that have sold the fastest that I can see are the spectacular places, the high-end places, the best thing on any 3 or 4 block area. They're, you know, they've got a lot of visibility. People have watched them being rehabbed. They've followed the whole story of the house, and that now this thing is on the market, and it's, you know, glitzed up, you know, beyond belief. And those places sell, and they sell relatively quickly. There's been 3 or 4 just in the last, you know, month or two around me. And, you know, I figured they would, because somebody clearly has you know, a niche of the market in mind when they develop these things, and they're not for what I would consider a typical family. They're for people who are maybe empty nesters, or they have a penchant for gardening, or they like a spectacular decorator space that they can make their own. But it isn't about, you know, a place to start a family or live there very long as a family. It's just not practical living for that kind of a home buyer. So those properties sell fast, and they seem to have no trouble finding places to tear down and, you know, put these things up or reconfigure them. But the other stuff that isn't particularly special and, you know, doesn't pop your eyes when you drive past it, it's, you know, got good bones to it and, you know, could make some family happy. It still needs so much work and, you know, so much tender, loving care that all that means to a home buyer now is money, money, money. It doesn't, you know, they don't really have a dream about fixing this house to their own taste because they know they'll be bankrupt trying to do it. So I it's a really odd, you know, pull with nobody in the middle, pretty much. And I guess, you know, people at the very low end can, you know, depend on subsidized housing or, you know, homeless encampments, and we're putting $40 million into, you know, housing the homeless in Chicago now. You know, I just think that that means you're going to have more homeless people. Doesn't mean that they'll be living any better. And then you got people at the high end who, you know, doing just okay. They're fine. They don't, you know, but those are not, neither of those are the typical home buyer. They don't really fit the profile of most Americans. So it's a very distorted market.
Well, it's important to start on the rental side, though, too, right? I mean, the rents aren't any, I mean, this is kind of an off-the-wall question, but if I had to do some, if I was anywhere near a school, then I could get a couple guys to work on this, because I wouldn't want to do it all myself. It seems like it's an odd phenomenon here, and you guys will opine on it. You're my brightest real estate people. The people, and again, I just judge from a lot of odds clients and so forth. A lot of them are, you know, a lot of them have retired and whatever. They're looking, they bought a house, you know, whatever, 25, 30 years ago in the mid 100s, say, and now they're selling it for, you know, 400. They're going to grab they're also rolling over their 401k, maybe to an IRA someplace. They made a lot of money on stocks. Their wealth is pretty up considering, and now they're going to, you know, take $50,000 out of there and they're going to buy a place for 450 cash. Real nice. Now, you know, a nice shack, a nice townhouse or whatever. Not a huge house for 450, but a nice place. And I just, at no point during their career, when I say they husband and wife or whatever, at no point during their career did they ever make enough to buy this place. It's all this wealth bubble, which I'm not, you know, obviously I manage money for people. I love the wealth bubble because my clients are happy. But I've never seen anything like this in any economic history I've ever read or here, to where this bubble that, fortunately, because of 401ks, regular people have participated in it to a large extent. It's nowhere in their working career of 40 years could they ever have come close to making enough and saving enough for $450,000 house. And so, and the people now aren't making that much more than they did when they were in their 30s or 40s. A little bit, I say a little bit. Say it's 40% more, or 50. Somehow or another, there's a house of cards here that I just can't get my hands around. And I hope I'm wrong. Tell me I'm wrong.
I don't think you're wrong, Tom. It is a house of cards.
But that doesn't mean we want to sell stocks today. It doesn't mean we want to go out and puke our house out. I mean, what's the end game on it?
I think people have a very different, you know, idea now about where real estate fits into their plans for their happiness or their growth as a family. It doesn't mean it's off the table. It doesn't mean that you know, people don't think about it, but they've really changed their thinking about it. And I think in a certain, you know, slice of the population, the ones who are not earning, you know, $80,000 a year, they've pulled back so far on the plans they have for A, either owning a house, or B, the kind of house it will be and how long they can hang on to it, that they have moved on to other things. You know, they'll rent probably and maybe pay a little bit more over the short term in order to save money over the long term. And I guess that's, you know, understandable given, you know, kind of, you know, uncertain, you know, employment situation we're in now with jobs being, you know, so uncertain. and you know, people with educations not being able to get decent paying jobs, let alone enough to start a family. So I think real estate is in a different category for these people, and I think real estate people surely see this in the way they talk about what they want to do. And you can see, you know, the crestfallen faces when they find out they can't build or buy the house they thought they could and had dreamed about for a lot of their years. So they've taken that energy and maybe gone into other things. Maybe they save money for travel. They save money for, you know, fancier things, stuff they can enjoy today and not worry about whether they can afford it later on or not. So real estate's kind of off. You know, it's not uppermost in most people's minds at all anymore.
Well, I would say that and I don't really want to go down necessarily that this is where we want to go, but if we're going to continue to pour money in the system like we are now, and Trump is all over himself to do even more, and guess what? The guy's a real estate person, and the single biggest people who benefit from inflationary society are real estate people. And he is what he is. I mean, in Germany, by the way, he's German too. In Germany, the Weimar Republic started, they poured money into the system, and you're eviscerating your population. The first thing people did with mortgages and run and pay them off, because you made out like a bandit. Because there's no way that anybody now who's, and this is, again, this is not advice, if they continue to do that, which I hope they don't, you can't rent at all for your future. You got to get something. You unfortunately got to get on the train if the train's going to keep going. Now the question is the train going to keep going? Or will it be able to keep going? I guess it's even more of a, because right now it's bizarre world. I mean, the idea that nobody can afford stuff and it keeps going up. I mean, that's a monetary phenomenon. I don't know, Nance, what do you think? I mean, a renter now is going to get this, but what's the rent going to be 10 years from now? $20,000 a month?
You know, sooner or later the bubble will break, right?
That's one
part. 2008.
Well, yeah, but rational people came to the determination we can't keep doing this, and they cut back on it. We've got people now that wanted to do more. I mean, where's the rationale from either side in Washington, John? I mean, who's going to say we can't keep going like this? Who's going to put any kind of policy together right now that drops the value of the stock market? Talk about suicide, right?
Yeah.
It's become the opiate of the people. It's not. You think Nvidia is a stock now? Everybody looks at it and says they're going to make this money coming forward. It goes up every day. It's something nobody's ever even seen before other than 1999, right? I mean, we're not talking about a market here, are we?
No, it's the stuff on which dreams are made.
Yeah.
I just watched the Maltese Falcon last night.
Yeah. Give the quote again. What Humphrey Bogart said what?
Well, he says, it's the stuff of which dreams are made of. And I think the Shakespeare line is what dreams are made on. So there's a little liberty, the screenplay, but that's okay.
Well, Nance,
he's fondling the fake falcon, you know, as a movie.
Nance, good luck to you this week. And hey, if you're bored, you can come out like every day. You got nothing else to do.
I'm sure. Let's see how this goes.
I think it'll be fine. SP Futures up 14, NASDAQ Futures up 93. Jimmy, nice job. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
And the final for the Caddyshack theme.